Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 23rd. Today's session is Jesus Makes a Difference, In and Out of the Wilderness, Go Apostolic Adventure, presented by Stan Olson. The number is 015-2002-05. Let's listen in.
Talk about crossing boundaries. Then the third day, we looked at some of the food miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 and the story of the Last Supper, and noticed how there's a connection in the language between those two stories, and talked about how for the followers of Jesus, for the community of Christ, those two go together. They're meant to be connected. That meal, that sacrament, what we call sacramental meal, not a biblical term, but that significant meal, and the ordinary meal, the ordinary hungers, they go back together. Our ordinary hungers ought to be reminding us of the presence of Christ in bread and wine. The bread and wine of the Lord's Supper ought to be reminding us of our daily food. And we talked about the understanding of that as gift and the implication that if it is gift, then it is to be shared. That all goes together as part of the picture. T-shirt that day was our ELCA Stand With Africa campaign to fight hunger and AIDS and to seek peace in Africa. Yesterday, we looked at what I called hard cases, death, thorns, and hard cases, where we were in the miracle stories, and some of them, things don't happen, or the disciples aren't able to cast out the demon. And the fact that not every demoniac was healed, Jesus went to his hometown, he couldn't do many miracles, couldn't do many mighty works there, except he healed a few people. It's one of the little jokes in Mark, I think. But the point is, he marveled at their unbelief. So we talked about what is faith, what is unfaith. Very clear that the gifts of God, of Jesus, of God in fulfillment are not dependent upon something that the person does. One can cite cases where it's the parent who comes and the child is healed, or the friends who let the paralytic down through the roof. So it's not the one who's ill who has faith. And then there are other stories where there's no mention of faith at all. The classic one is the story of the widow of Nain, the son of the widow of Nain. Jesus is coming into town. He meets a funeral procession coming out. Nobody in the funeral party says anything to him, according to the story anyway. Jesus just stops and heals the young man. So it's not that faith isn't understood as something that must be contributed by the person to the healing, but there is that sense of openness, of receiving the gift of God. We talked about we talked about miracles that don't happen. We had in the second session, for those of you there, we had a wonderful witness story from one of the men in the group about the death of his own. We had looked at a story about a paralytic boy who was healed. They'd had that story, and then finally how coming to terms with it for my daughter. And in fact, it gets at one of the things I want to talk about today, that the apostolic means to be sent. An apostle is one who is sent, an emissary. We are all sent by God out into the world, into our daily lives, whether one is retired or just heading into a career or still in school. We are sent to those places. The Lutheran term for this is into our callings, into our sendings, I might want to say this morning. I use the term adventurer to suggest to you that there's always a freshness. Whether you go back to your teaching or to your child care or to your studies or to your retirement activities, your volunteering, that there is a sense of adventure because we don't, Christ sends us out to do what may turn out to be unexpected or expected. If you go mountain climbing, you know a lot of what's going to happen, but there's also the unexpected. So the two go together, and you are ready for both. But let's start with some texts. Mark 3, starting with verse 11, right in the middle of the paragraph there. This always looks wrong when I start a bit. I'm starting in the middle of this, so I'm just going to give you the end of the story. Well, let me go back to verse 9, then it'll make a little more sense in context. 3:9. Jesus told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowds, that they would not crush him. For he had cured many, so that all who had diseases pressed upon him to touch him. And remember what we talked about, this pressing upon him to touch him? This one amounts to, this is Mark's understanding of faith. They come to him seeking the gift that he can give. Whenever the unclean spirits saw Jesus, they fell down before him and shouted, "You are the Son of God." We've also seen this in other stories, that the demons, the unclean spirits, are portrayed as knowing who Jesus is, but having a partial knowledge. They don't really understand the implications of that. He sternly ordered them not to make him known. Orders the demons not to make him known. Not to ask him. We talked about this a little bit one other day. It's sometimes called the Messianic secret or the Christ secret in Mark. And it's not really ever explained, but the point apparently is that until you've gotten to the cross and resurrection, you don't know the whole story. If you only see Jesus as a wonder worker, it's inadequate. But so what I want you to notice here is, sternly order them not to make him known. Then go on to verse 13. He went up to the mountain and called to him those whom he wanted, and they came to him. He's called his disciples earlier. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, to be with him, and to be sent out to proclaim the message and to have authority to cast out demons. Demons are silenced. Then he calls this group and appoints 12 of them, whom he calls apostles, sent ones, and he sends them out to proclaim the message and to have authority to cast out demons. So here we have a contrast between those who don't quite understand, those who have only their self-interest at heart, who are silenced, and then the disciples who are sent with a message and with power to do good. Now look at chapter 5, 1 to 20. This is a long one here. I don't think I'll take time to read the whole thing because I'm only going to talk about the end. This is actually the longest miracle story in the Gospel of Mark. It's the one about the demonic man with a demon in the country of Gerasene, and where Jesus has the long dialogue with him. "We are many. My name is Legion." In other words, many. And they say, "Well, don't just throw us out. Give us someplace to go. How about if we go into that herd of pigs over there?" So Jesus says, "All right, get out of there. Go into the pigs." They do. The pigs go tearing down into the ocean and are destroyed. An odd little piece. Presumably, first of all, based on some kind of recollection, Jesus was there, created the disturbance, the pigs went into the ocean. You know, who knows what's behind it? It may have a Jewish overtone. The pig is an unclean animal and therefore no big loss. Having grown up on a hog farm, you know, this always seemed to me an odd story. And I had a lot of sympathy with these swineherds who you will now hear about. Let's start with verse 14. The swineherds ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and they saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had the legion, and they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's the 10 cities, it's 10 cities in the eastern region of Palestine, began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. They responded appropriately. They were amazed. Wonder, awe. They heard about this. He cast the demons out of this guy who had been uncontrollable, and the pigs, the herd of swine went into the ocean. They weighed the evidence, asked him to leave the neighborhood. You know, benefits, deficits.
One thing I never understood about this story is that when I really started to visualize like everything that was happening, okay, so you make thousands of pigs fall off a cliff into the ocean, into the very spot where you're going to be very shortly getting to your boat. But I was just wondering, trying to think about the boat ride was like with the disciples, you know, like steering through all the pigs.
I'm fairly confident that Mark doesn't want you to go there.
They quickly washed out to sea.
This is the Sea of Galilee. This is not a big ocean, right?
It's
capacity to cleanse itself. We got an environmental issue here. But as I said, those are questions that we're going to get hung up on the detail. There's nothing wrong with asking the question, but what I want you to look at here is this emphasized ending of the story. You remember I suggested you pay attention to what gets expanded. Now in this particular story, everything is expanded. It was obviously an intriguing story and it really got remembered with lots of details and passed on. But look at the ending, the emphasis on he wants to come with him. We've just heard about the disciples, those who he called to him, and the followers, the sent ones, and he begs to go along. He wants to be a disciple. Interesting, they began to beg Jesus to leave the neighborhood. He begs to go with Jesus, and Jesus says, "No, you go back. You go home." Go, same word, commission. You go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown to you. So sends him back to the community that has asked Jesus to leave. So it's ascending. We have the disciples, and then the report that he in fact did it. He went back, said how much Jesus had done for him, and people responded with amazement. We get that kind of people responded with amazement report at several places in the Gospel of Mark.
But these are Gentiles.
That's a little unclear. Okay. It's not a detail that the storyteller seems to care about.
I know.
But if they're raising pigs.
Yes.
But the cities of the Decapolis wouldn't necessarily be Gentile. So it's one of those puzzlements in trying to understand this story. But we've got the disciples sent out into the world with the message. We have the demoniac, formerly demoniac man, sent home, but with the same purpose, to tell the story. Now look at the last chapter of Mark. Actually, I'm just going to look at the last two verses, Mark 16, 7 to 8. We talked about this funny ending yesterday. The oldest, best manuscripts of Mark end abruptly at verse 8, where they said nothing to anyone for they were afraid. Two very ancient endings are preserved, which are probably neither of them original to the gospel. We don't know whether it really did end there or if the last page fell off. You know, cheap paperbacks, you've had this problem by the time you get to the end, the last pages are missing. The Christian period coincides with the shift from the scroll to the codex, which in other words, book form. It's happening at this same time, and it's a more efficient method. I mean, it's almost counterpart to the printing press and the Reformation. You get a technological advancement that helps spread the message because it's easier. Codices can be copied more easily, passed on more easily. But you couldn't lose a page. So that may be what happened. But think about how, if this were the actual ending. Remember, throughout Mark, we see some pretty incompetent disciples. They just don't get it. They blow it again and again and again and again. At the crucifixion, they run off. In this story in Mark, the three women from the disciples, keep this in mind, these are not just extras, these are disciples, the three women who come to the tomb. They encounter the young man in the tomb who said, Jesus is not here, he's risen. This is a miracle story, although it is the miracle story. And they come to the young man, and he says, verse 7, go tell his disciples and Peter that he's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. They're given a commission. Go. Same thing again. So, it says, they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. End of book. If it is the end of the book, how does that impact you as a hearer? They were given a commission. We've seen the blundering disciples all through. We've now heard of the greatest miracle, which we the readers, of course, already know about. We know about the crucifixion and the resurrection and the existence of the church, and that the message did in fact get out, despite what's said here. But what's the impact of that if that is the end of the gospel? How would you respond to hearing that as the end?
Seems very depressing. Like, you're supposed to be the greatest event of all, and these disciples are too petrified to spread the news. You know, that they're not going out and sharing mm-hmm. this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're just kind of stuck in their own fear.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite natural.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the population and that the followers of Jesus were not a large number of people, and you go and tell about this, and well, what's going to happen to me?
Mm-hmm.
And our group, I don't think it's too unnatural.
No?
Think if it happened today, you know, how would we feel about that?
And would we believe it? Yeah. And if the women ran in and told the disciples what they saw, would the disciples believe them? Because we have from the other Gospels that John and Peter run back to check him out.
It seemed to them an idle tale.
Yes.
You remember, yes, that in the other Gospel version. Steve?
To me, that kind of ending creates great tension.
Mm-hmm.
It almost, if someone was reading it out loud and they got to that point, you would have an explosion of discussion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It would kind of land right in the middle of the group. It mm-hmm. would sort of make you part of that group.
Mm-hmm. Good. I do think literally that's what's going on here with this, and that's why it's at least defensible to say this really was the end of the gospel. And several ancient readers said this won't do. We can't leave it that way because they didn't see. But if it creates tension in the group, it creates tension among the hearers. One could assume that it's at least potentially a salutary tension. It was a, well, we can't be like that. No. They blew it. And as I said, the disciples have been portrayed this way all along. Not those 12 guys with, or 10, 11 guys, and with their portraits up there, and some key women who didn't get added until the 20th century. Although, come listen to Barb this afternoon, and she'll help you remember that actually there were some key women there right from the start. Just didn't get written down much, but that sense of it's people like you, it's blundering people like you, who are the only means we've got. And yes, of course your fears are natural, but you've got that. It's that sending thing that I think is so key. Go with the story. Go despite your fears. You are sent on an adventure, and part of that adventure is just downright scariness. I referred to Jonathan earlier. If I were so foolish as to agree to go
hiking with Jonathan in the mountain. Marion is up there. If I were so foolish to agree to go on one of his real adventures, I'd like to go on a minor adventure. But I would go with a certain amount of anxiety. But you know, the adrenaline. There's the adventurers expect that. In fact, we want it. Lest I forget to say this later, let me see, I'll say it and I'll probably pick it up again later. We ought not think of the commission as step two. It's not, they're changed by Jesus and then they are told, now if you want to, you should do this. But it's integral enough to the story that I think we assume it's part of step one. You are changed and you are sent to tell. Tell what the impact has been on you, on others. I'll look at now at two texts from Paul. First of all, from Romans chapter 13.
There's a question back here.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Mrs. Olson.
but somebody talked.
Right. I mean, as soon as you start pressing this a little bit, you realize, now wait a minute. Maybe they didn't tell tomorrow, but they must have. Otherwise, how do we know the story? And the other Gospels tell it differently. You know, we've got four Gospels. They tell essentially the same story, but they each tell it in their own way, with different kinds of themes. And Mark is ordinarily understood to be the first one. So you've got Matthew and Luke improving on Mark, or retelling Mark for a different community and bringing in some other materials. John probably hasn't ever seen Mark when he tells the story. There the tradition has been preserved in another community and was told in a different way. But you're right. We wouldn't know that if they hadn't in fact talked about it.
So. Also, I've been told, you know, one of the things I've been told about Mark is that maybe Mark was Peter telling the story and written it down, because Peter's in it in a way that he's not in the other Gospels. I mean, like, go tell the disciples and Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Peter the denial is in there. Peter looking pretty,
yeah,
Peter.
That's a really ancient tradition that there's a sort of Peter's notes, Peter's recollections behind the Gospel of Mark. I think it's second century at least that some of the early church writers allude to that Mark had talked to Peter and gotten Peter's recollections. It's not it's just an ancient tradition. It's not anything we can document. If it's Peter, he certainly hasn't polished things up. He's painted himself in pretty stark light. But I didn't comment about that phrase. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Remember, Peter denied him. And that really seems to anticipate a rehabilitation story. And the fact that go and you will see him as he told you, that too seems to anticipate that we ought to have some narration of those encounters. So the argument for a lost ending is probably stronger than saying
I don't think it has to be a lost ending. I know that. I just think that they were scared, and then what you said earlier too, about when you've had a real bad experience, sleeping on it makes things look better in the morning.
Sure.
That maybe the next morning they said, well, let's go do it now.
And if we could do what I might call a feminist reading, if they said nothing to anyone, in other words, they didn't tell the key men.
They sure told the other women.
But they're also women, and women haven't had much power in that time at all. And wondered, gee, who's going to believe us?
Yeah. And, there is.
Yeah, and there's fear there. Mm-hmm. They may have discussed it themselves and later on told.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at that point, they didn't feel brave enough to do so.
Yeah. And all of these are questions we ought to be asking, but again, I come back to my suggestion that we also try to read the document that we've got and just figure out, how does it work this way? Yeah.
But the thing is that the apostles, I mean, you know, they're all sitting in a room being scared to death. If the women come over and are like, you know,
this and this just happened and everything. They're going to be like, you guys are crazy. I don't believe you.
Sure. You're hysterical.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yep. In the morning, you just need to get some sleep. They're not going to listen.
Yeah, you mean one could understand why they wouldn't do it. You remember the musical Amal and the Night Visitors? Have you ever heard of that? Amal goes to the door. Amal, the chronic storyteller, liar, goes to the door, and the magi are there. And he goes back and tells his mother, says, "Who's at the door?" He says, "If I tell you, you won't believe me." No, there is that experience.
The Gospels were all written for Christian communities. They weren't written along with the experience. I mean, they weren't written step by step throughout the life of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me, and I think what I heard you saying, is that in part this is a literary technique. This is Mark not telling what happens afterwards in order to remind you about the humanness of the disciples and their call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark has invented a literary form here. There really are no good analogies to what Mark is doing. If you go back into other literature in this period, in any culture actually, we don't have good analogies. We're so used to biographies. This is not a biography. And you're right, it's written for a Christian community. Everything in the New Testament is written for Christian community. We don't have any what we might call evangelical tracts. This is not trying to convert unbelievers. So even if the story about Peter's rehabilitation and the appearances aren't in this story, they already know them. That's in, you know, that's one of the favorites they hear from old Simon when it's his turn to tell the stories of the community. So, yeah, it's an interesting little piece. Paul?
What is the new part that he has come up with that would not have been projected or told before in that style?
Sure. I mean, if you, one of the things, of course, you would do would be to look in the Old Testament. Is there any analogy in the Old Testament? And we have what's called the Elijah-Elisha cycle. The two prophets, Elijah and Elisha, one commissioning the other, both doing miracles, both encountering the king. But it doesn't build to a climax like this one does. It doesn't stand by itself. Although there may well have been an oral tradition of telling the Elijah Elisha stories. The long narrative of the people of Israel, well, from Abraham to the Exodus, that one in some ways tells a narrative, but not about an individual. So there, it's just this combination of story, even of Jesus' stories, parables, of things about him, of his sayings. Mark is often described as a passion story, suffering and death, crucifixion story, with an extended introduction, and that everything pushes in that direction. It's getting to that point. Good. Here, let's look at Romans. Romans 13:11-14. This is Paul now. Still, I would suggest talking to apostolic adventurers. His number of admonitions in chapters 12 and 13 of Romans, then here in 11, besides this, you know what time it is, how it is now the moment for you to wake from sleep. The image is you've awakened, you know your alarm is going to go off in 15 minutes. I assume that was what Paul was thinking. And it's time. It's the day is ahead of you. This is a hopeful image. This is not doom. This is promise. Salvation is nearer to us now than when we became believers. The night is far gone. The day is at hand. And then this. Let us. What he's doing here is essentially saying, be what you are. Be what Christ has made you. Let us lay aside the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us live honorably as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, nor in quarreling and jealousy. Instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. Paul does this a number of places where he says, be what you are. You are not
the works of the flesh are this, the works of the Spirit are this. The fruits of the Spirit are this. This is who you are. You are to be characterized by love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, all that stuff. It's Christ's work in you. Let it happen. It is again. He's still talking about part of step one, not step two, but part of step, this is who Christ has made you. T-shirt time. This text is 2 Corinthians 5:17, 5:17 and 18. I'm going to read to you. So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. I didn't particularly like this theme, actually, because they kind of made it into a want in, made it into a question, and I think that that makes it sound like a demand to me. Rather, it's a proclamation, it's an invitation. In Christ, all things are new, and part of that newness is that you are given a ministry of reconciliation. You are sent. Apostolic adventurer, sent out to be part of God's reconciling work, and that continues on if we read more here in 2 Corinthians.
So what's it say in the IN?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, you can't read that. It's Christ. Christ, 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 on the in here.
And what does it say?
In Christ. 2 Corinthians 5:17.
Oh.
The notion of being, what does it mean to be in Christ? And actually I didn't comment on it in the Romans text, of putting on Christ. I've used that image, that language with you before. It's not about picking some Christian tasks to do. It's about being a Christian. It's about being the adventurer that Christ has made you to be. Wherever you find yourself, that is where God is giving you work to do in your callings. Okay, I think I'm actually just about ready to give you some discussion issues. Changed and sent, part of the same thing. Oh, I skipped a text, I guess, that I was going to read. It's appropriate to take a look at a text like 1 Corinthians 12, where, let's just do it. 1 Corinthians 12, 4 to 7. This whole chapter is about the variety of God's gifts, common source, common purpose. Let me read verse 4 to 7. There are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are varieties of services, but the same Lord. And there are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who activates them all in every one. Nice Trinitarian, Lord, God, Spirit, God. Same source. To each is given a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. For the common good, for the good of all. We are all different. This chapter is written to a community that's getting torn apart because I don't have the gift that so-and-so has, or there seems to be some of that going on, feelings of inferiority and some feelings of superiority. If you were a real Christian, you would have the gift of tongues. And Paul rejects both of those things. You ought not feel inferior and you ought not feel superior. Every Christian is given the gift for the common good, which is a persistent theme in Paul and elsewhere. I read a phrase the other day that I really liked, that we are God's future. God's people are God's future in the world. And I think that fits very well with what I see in these miracle stories. The sense of wonder that God is still at work in the world, and in ways that we partially understand and partially don't understand, and that we are then changed to continue to be part of that, to be part of God's work in the world, and therefore we are God's future. We are the community that moves forward. The sending includes the telling, and if I were to ask some of you to start telling me the stories of what God has done in you, many of those stories would also include a reference to some other person. So Jane tells me a story about the impact of Louise on her life. And there we have mentioned already of two apostolic adventurers. And if we asked Louise, we'd hear about the apostolic adventurers who impacted her life. And we are God's future in the world, and we are sent. I sometimes, maybe just because I'm a restless, antsy person myself, I talk about Christian restlessness. That we are content in Christ, but we are never comfortable as though we assume that everything has always already happened. That there is a future. God is at work. There's a future for us. I talked about this a little bit yesterday with the miracles that don't happen. But there's a restlessness, a readiness to go. That's the adventurer theme. Tell me a bit of, I'll take questions or comments, but also tell me a bit about your Christian restlessness, or what do you sense God sending you to do? What's happened? Or questions or comments along any line?
I think sometimes God intentionally, you encounter somebody, like I've been holding here for years. I've kind of thought, oh, it really would be interesting to be in Bread for the World and do something with that. And then I just kind of put it on the back burner. And so who do I meet up here but Tammy, who is the coordinator for the district that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, you know, you might not go out and seek, but somehow a person is planted there. At least that's the way I'm encountering.
Yeah, I mean, and... is that just a nice coincidence? This is a place that draws that kind of people. People like Mary Knudsen and Terry. And so, but you can tell that as a miracle story, and which is really what you just did. And as a miracle story, interesting with a commission in it, ascending. Now maybe I do actually find some way to get involved in Bread for the World. Yeah.
For me, it's kind of the opposite. I'll be starting my senior year of seminary when you need to declare, you know, what type of ministry that you want to do.
Parish ministry in southwestern Minnesota. I've been sent to tell you that. I'm sorry.
The more I pray about a discernment and what type of ministry to be involved in, it seems like the bigger the blank from my eyes becomes. Mm-hmm. And yet within the blank, the types of things within that become clearer and clearer and clearer. You know, like looking at congregations on conflict and seeing ways to deal with that and helpful ways, and, you know, looking at our relationship with Christians around the globe and having that be something that unites us and really strengthens and brings joy to the community wherever I am, and looking at, you know, the ways in which we live our lives and seeing how that can be wholeness within our communities as you know, as we strengthen these relationships and seeing all the wonderful gifts that people have for ministry and just rejoicing, you know, and strengthening and enriching and empowering those. So it's an odd balance of having absolutely not being able to have a clear picture at all about, you know, the type of parish or the type of ministry, but at the same time having a growing awareness of, you know, what's important wherever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, good. I can't help but think of the Holden, what I call the Holden Village Prayer, referred to Wednesday night. Lord, you have called us to ventures of which we cannot see the ending, by paths as yet untrodden and through perils unknown. Let us go out with good courage, not knowing where we are going, but only that your hand is leading us and your love supporting us.
I pray that often.
and I do it now as I head into a new job. The commissioning isn't always
isn't always so clear, go back to the Decapolis, or go home.
Right.
It is sometimes like, it is the go out. Can you imagine the 12 disciples? Jesus sends them out, and they stop outside the door.
Where?
No, but, well, let's the two of us go this way, okay? And there is a blank where you can check on that form, open to all.
That's why you're having a vision of
the other observations, comments, questions.
Actually, some of it's like for me, I'm older, so I don't have that restlessness anymore because I just know it's going to come, you know. And I just wait and it comes. Take advantage of it. I don't get restless about it.
Okay. All right. So that's probably just me. There is something about your time.
When you're younger, you're more concerned about that. But now you just know, hold his hands and wipe it, you know.
I guess I would call myself restless in terms of, as far as my faith life, thinking about the older I get and situations that you're confronted with and things that you thought you had black and white answers to, now things become more gray. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's necessarily bad. Because, you know, I think initially you think the Bible has all these answers for you and in all the situations in your life, and quite frankly, it doesn't. And basically,
it's
what
not
it does.
An answer book, it's a question book.
That's right. I guess the purpose of it for me is to just create a transformation inside of myself. And that's kind of where I'm at. I think maybe I used to look to the Bible more for answers. And I'm not saying there isn't any.
No.
You know, but
to treat it as though every question will have a direct and clear answer is to misunderstand what this book is. It's a collection of the testimonies of, the stories of, and the problems of the people of God over a couple thousand, well, not a couple thousand years, but over hundreds of years. Which to me just it keeps me open to read some of these things and to see new things or to listen to somebody else talk about what they have seen. Even if I disagree with what somebody else has found in there, it still sharpens for me a sense of what that might mean for us and for me. Other questions, comments?
I would like to reflect on something that has been on my mind for some time. About a year and a half ago, Diane Shriner made a trip around different congregations to give us more information about Holden and a picture of the ministry that goes on here at Holden. Now, we have been at Holden many times, and at the time she was at this particular church, she asked people, how do you feel about Holden? And there were very few that come forth. Afterwards, I thought about this question, and I wrote down a few notes, and I sent it to Diane, and I said something, we go to the mountain to have our batteries charged. And when we come here, I say to myself, Lord, it's good to be here. Just like Peter said, let us build three booths.
Or 13 chalets.
One for Moses and one for me. I want to stay a while. And the Lord rebukes me and he says, do you not know that you are sent to minister in Bellevue, Kirkland, Seattle, wherever.
Southern Minnesota.
The story, of course, is a copy, if you will, of what's related in at least three of the Gospels. And that brings forth that the last fall we were here, Pastor Johnson had a session, Work as Worship. We are sent forth to minister wherever we live.
Yeah, good, wonderful, thank you. One of Martin Luther's themes that I think is really important and continues to be neglected in church, the church in general, and including in the Lutheran Church, is this notion of that this sending is to all people. So let me try to say again that when I talk about apostolic adventurers, I'm not talking about preachers. I've got one senior seminarian here that I am trying to recruit. but otherwise, we're talking about about all your callings, that God is sending you into those many roles of your life, which are just as important as the one who stands in the pulpit or who leads the choir. And in your own life, there are times when telling us the story of Jesus is important and appropriate. Whatever your daily work is, or whether you're retired, there are times when that's important. But again, equally important is the way you live your everyday life.
Yes.
Teacher in Bahrain, you have opportunities to witness by who you are and how you teach. That's very critical. I think about a place like Holden, and give thanks for the existence of these places and for those. When I went to this, I was here for the staff meeting the other night. This room was full of staff. Every chair and all around the balcony was full of staff. And all the people that make this possible for those of us who come in and go out on short term. I think of one friend in particular who spent quite a bit of time here and then became a parish pastor and was very frustrated, and he realized what he was doing was that he wanted to recreate Holden Village in that congregation. And in one sense, it ought to be more possible than it is, but you also have to know that it's impossible because this is an isolated, specialized situation. But that image of renewal, of being among, well, I was going to say like-minded people, I think that's okay, although we are a tremendously diverse community that God is at work. Other comments? Questions? Okay. I haven't given you my word picture yet for this morning, so I'll do that. Follow me. Why don't artists show Jesus looking back at us over his shoulder? His word is follow me. He hurries through factories, schools, restaurants, homes, farms, hospitals, offices. Always he's moving ahead and looking back, calling encouragement, beckoning with his hand. Follow, come with me, follow my lead. Don't give us a painting with a somber Jesus staring deep into our hearts, demanding we save ourselves. Don't give us a sculpture with a passive Jesus smiling at some inner thought. Give us an eager Jesus hurrying on to do good news, drawing us forward. Show him looking back with energy, direction, and excitement. Show us looking ahead, moving ahead. We follow. Jesus makes a difference. You've made a difference for me this day, and I thank you for that, and pray God's blessings on each one of you. Have a good day. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.